Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Hearings on President Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee are scheduled for mid-October, with a major philosophical shift on the court at stake.
This is more like when Clarence Thomas replaced Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, kind of a liberal lion on the court, and Justice Thomas, one of the most conservative justices ever to sit on the court.
We talked to Widener University Delaware Law School professor John Culhane about the president's nominee and the impact the confirmation could have. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in with the Delaware Department of Labor about how it's dealing with unemployment claims in the pandemic, and take a closer look at what's next for statues taken down in the wake of racial justice protests. Plus, another edition of Arts Playlist. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. An already partisan and polarized election season saw a new, unexpected issue emerge, adding to the divisive atmosphere. The death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg leaves a vacancy to fill on the nation's highest court with a little more than a month before Election Day. The decision to try to fill that seat before the election, and President Trump's choice to replace the liberal Ginsburg, conservative Amy Coney Barrett, have created new battle lines and have implications for the cases that will be heard in the court's new term starting this month and for years to come. Earlier this week, Widener University Delaware Law School professor and H. Albert Young Fellow in Constitutional Law, John Culhane, joined us to discuss the Supreme Court vacancy and what lies ahead this term and beyond. Let's start with President Trump's nominee for the court, Amy Coney Barrett. What are a couple of key things you feel people should know about her background and qualifications?
All right. So let's start with her qualifications, which I think are apparent. She is a very bright and a very able jurist. She's been on the Federal Court of Appeals for 3 years, which is a short tenure. But her writing is crisp. It's easy to understand. She has a good reputation from her time in the Legal Academy. She was a law professor at Notre Dame and wrote some law review articles that are of high quality. So I think her qualifications are fine. I think anyone that would dispute that, I think, is not being honest. I think the other question, though, is what are her views and what are her opinions, and are those sort of in step with the, general views of the public? And I think there the answer is quite different.
Yes, I was going to say, if confirmed, considering that she's replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obviously a much more liberal justice over the course of her time on the court, what would be a Justice Barrett would be a much more conservative justice. And is it fair to say that this would constitute one of the larger philosophical shifts from one justice to another that the court's seen in some time?
That's exactly right. I mean, when you look at the most recent few changes, we had, Justice Kavanaugh replacing Justice Kennedy. Okay, maybe that was a move to the right, but not a substantial one. We had Justice Gorsuch replacing Justice Scalia, two conservatives. So those were not kind of earth-shaking. This is more like when Clarence Thomas replaced Thurgood Marshall, Thurgood Marshall, kind of a liberal lion on the court, and Justice Thomas, one of the most conservative justices ever to sit on the court. And so it's somewhat more along those lines.
As we head into the confirmation hearings that are expected to happen later this month, are there some things we do know a little bit about where she stands on various issues that would, I guess, be most pertinent for people to know about what she's bringing to the court?
Yeah. I mean, there's a real paper trail here, both from her career as an academic and even from her few years as an appellate court judge. So I think one of the biggest issues that is going to be front and center during the confirmation hearings is her views on abortion. It's apparent that she thinks Roe versus Wade was improperly decided. She, during her confirmation hearings for the federal appellate court, she said she regarded it as settled precedent, but that's true when you're an appellate court judge. when you're a Supreme Court justice, of course, what's precedent is up to you. And she has said that she thinks the principle of respecting earlier decisions, what we call stare decisis as lawyers, doesn't really apply with as much force to controversial decisions like Roe versus Wade. And her views on abortion are quite well known. She opposes it. In a case before the Federal Court of Appeals, she joined a dissent on an issue that the state hadn't even asked the court to weigh in on, and it had to do with whether the state of Indiana could make it illegal to perform an abortion for the purpose of choosing the sex, race of a child, or to abort a child based on disabilities. And, you know, the Supreme Court precedent was pretty clear that the state can't place any substantial obstacle in a woman's path to choose an abortion. But she joined a dissent that basically did not respect that precedent, that would have allowed that Indiana statute to go into effect. So there's a real clear case where, while saying she respected the precedent and called it settled, she joined a dissent that really kind of tried to work around a pretty clear statement by the Supreme Court. So that's just one example in the context of abortion. There are a couple of other abortion cases, but I think that's the one that kind of jumps out at me. But she's also on things like the Affordable Care Act, which the court will be hearing arguments on right after the election. She expressed a disagreement with Justice Roberts' deciding opinion in a case a few years ago that upheld the Affordable Care Act. And she felt as though he had stretched the meaning of the law sort of out of reasonable proportion to save it. So, you know, if she has a vote on the Affordable Care Act in this case that's coming before the court, she could supply a necessary vote for striking it down. And this is a concern, obviously, to a lot of people. And then, of course, there's the biggest issue that I think people are starting to talk about quite seriously, which is President Trump, even last night during the debate, talked about what would happen if the election was contested and how he expected or thought it might go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court would then need to weigh in on whether ballots were properly counted, whether procedures were properly followed. And I think if I were a senator during the hearings, I would ask her if she would pledge to recuse herself on any cases that came before the court involving the election of the president who nominated her. I mean, it's a very strange position for her to be in.
I was going to say, is there any kind of precedent for that, or I guess is there anything that's codified that would make her feel that she needs to do that?
No. So unlike lower court judges, Supreme Court justices, and many people find this incredible, I know I do, they are not bound by those rules. So they get to decide for themselves whether they will recuse themselves in particular cases. Now, what they will say is that they will recuse themselves not only when they have a conflict, but even when there's an appearance of conflict. But the way that's been applied is not something that should give people a lot of hope that, and I'm not talking specifically about her.
Right.
I have no idea whether she would do this or not. But based on past refusals to recuse in situations where people thought it was really the right thing to do, it would be hard to predict that she would recuse herself. And that's why I think, even though at least it would have the appearance of impropriety for her to rule on a case involving the president, particularly if she were to rule in his favor in a situation where her nomination depended on him. So it's really an interesting case. And that's why I think if I were a senator, I would extract or try to extract that kind of a pledge from her. But, you know, whether she's willing to make that commitment, of course, we don't know.
Based on some of these things that you're saying, what are your thoughts on what the confirmation hearings might look like? What would you expect for them? How contentious do you suspect they'll be given the current environment and also the last hearing for Justice Kavanaugh?
Well, that hearing was one of the sort of worst displays we've seen in terms of certainly the worst display I've seen, even worse than the Clarence Thomas hearings, because, you know, Justice Kavanaugh, when he was accused of sexually assaulting Christine Blasey Ford, you know, had this kind of meltdown, and then Lindsey Graham had this meltdown, and it was just really an unseemly spectacle. And I don't think we're going to get that here. That happened because of the accusations and because people thought people on the Republican side thought they were, you know, drummed up at the last minute, and people on the Democratic side thought that she hadn't gotten a fair hearing. In this case, I don't expect the nominee to be attacked. I think that could sort of backfire. I think there'll be an investigation of her record that will be pretty probing. You know, they've got the votes to confirm her. So I don't know what the Democratic strategy will be, whether they have the idea of, well, let's, you know, try to, you know, shake her up or find something new. Some of them might boycott the hearings, feeling that that's a better statement to make than to participate in something they see as leading to a foregone conclusion. So it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen. But that heavy sigh was on purpose. I don't expect it to be, a fine example of our democracy in action. Let's just put it that way.
Well, you mentioned the ACA case that's going to come up week after the election itself.
Yeah.
How about the rest of this upcoming turn? Are there some other cases that are set to come before the court in this next year that could be significantly influenced by a shift with a Justice Barrett?
Well, you know, the court has been declining for years to take gun cases. And there has been a concern expressed principally by Justice Thomas that the court is treating the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, as kind of a second-class right, and they're not taking cases in which states have imposed, you know, strict regulations on, you know, different aspects of gun sales and ownership. And I think it's quite likely that with Amy Coney Barrett on board, who has expressed the idea gun rights should be expansively construed, it's not at all unlikely that they'll take a case and they will limit the regulations that states can place on gun ownership and sale. So they haven't taken a case like that yet. They're still figuring out their docket for the next year, but that seems to me quite likely. And then, of course, there's the election case, which I think, unless Joe Biden wins decisively, I think there will be litigation that's quite likely to get to the Supreme Court. And then, you know, an abortion, they might sort of, you know, cool it for a while and wait a year or two to take another case, because they just recently upheld a decision by a lower court that restricted abortions pretty substantially. So I think they might want to wait on abortion for another year or two. But I think, you know, ultimately that's going to come down the pike. And, you know, those are the cases and the areas of law that I think people are most concerned about.
You mentioned kind of holding off on abortion. Obviously, a change like this is a long-term change, because the justices have lifetime terms.
Well, and she's only 48.
Exactly. So as we look a little bit further down the road, you know, what are the implications of this shift? And I guess, are there some less obvious areas that this makeup of a court could yield significant changes?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that sort of goes unnoticed, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, who follows the text and who's an originalist. And I think, you know, what we really need to look at, because a lot of this is just window dressing for the policy positions and the results that the justices want to reach. And one of the things that's been most, sort of front and center has been the court's support in recent years. It's just gotten more conservative of businesses over other individuals, or I should say businesses over individuals. So, for instance, we had a case a couple of years ago where the court said that, forcing people to you know, to pay dues to the union, even if they weren't members, you know, because the union's getting benefits for them, is a violation of their free speech, because money is speech. And it's kind of the weaponizing of the First Amendment to, you know, to strike down regulations that make it more expensive for business to operate. And the idea there is the union won't be able to function if it doesn't have contributions from non-members. And that will strengthen, but that will sort of shift the balance between unions and employers. So, you know, that's one example. Of course, we know about Citizens United and the infusion of, you know, huge amounts of money into politics. I think those are the cases that don't get they're not the kind of the sexy constitutional law cases about LGBT rights or abortion. But those are the cases where I think you're going to see the biggest kind of pro-business shift from the court.
Thanks to Widener University Delaware Law School professor and H. Albert Young Fellow in Constitutional Law, John Colhane, for his time on The Green this week. And coming up next, we check in with the State Department of Labor to update its handling of unemployment claims in the first state that have spiked during the COVID-19 pandemic. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Like most other states, Delaware has received a flood of unemployment claims since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The state's monthly unemployment rate sat at 10.5% in August after hitting a pandemic peak of 15.8% in May. And the current number is still much higher than the 3.9% rate reported this time a year ago. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino recently spoke with Delaware Division of Unemployment Director Darrell Scott about the state's various efforts to pay jobless benefits during the pandemic, starting with the latest expansion of the Extended Benefits Program.
The Extended Benefits Program is typically a 13-week benefit, and it was authorized and funded by the federal government as part of the CARES Act that was signed earlier this year. For states that have a high unemployment period provision in their state code, there is an ability to trigger on an additional 7 weeks of benefits. And so what the secretary did recently was issue a rule, which he was granted that authority by the General Assembly in June to issue special rules. So what he in effect did was reinstate the high unemployment period trigger, which said if our unemployment rate over a 3-month period was greater than 8%, that we could trigger on the 7 additional weeks of benefits. And at this time, those 7 additional weeks will be funded 100% by the federal government. So the secretary's action, again, understanding people that were in need for unemployment benefits for an extended or for a longer period of time, was able to enact this special rule and, in effect, trigger on these additional weeks of benefits.
I imagine Delaware is certainly not alone in this. There's plenty of states that have had a high unemployment rate for that required amount of time. Is there any strain on the federal funding for this program, and would there need to be more funding approved by Congress at some point?
So the I'm sure that the additional weeks does add an additional, you know, constraint on the federal budget, but these benefits were authorized as part of the CARE Act's understanding that at this time or in times like this, that there are going to be individuals who will be unemployed for a longer period of time. So there's my understanding is there's no additional funds or no additional action that's required on the federal government's part. The extended, the 100% payment of these benefits does expire at the end of the year. And so if we remain in a high unemployment period beyond after December 31, then the state will pick up and be responsible for 50% of those benefit payments.
And can you offer some context as to how high the unemployment situation is in Delaware? What are some of the latest statistics, and compare that, if you will, to pre-pandemic Delaware unemployment?
So prior to the pandemic, prior to the pandemic, we were at about 4% unemployment in Delaware. In I believe it was June, we the 3-month rolling average peaked at 14.5, and in August we were down to 10.6. So we're still, for a 3-month rolling average, considerably higher than where we were at the beginning. I think the unemployment rate reported in August was for Delaware is about 9%. So we again, that's the one unique thing about this high unemployment period being triggered on and off, is that if the 3-month average falls below 8%, then we will trigger off the 7 additional weeks of benefits, and we'll return to the 13 weeks of extended benefit, the 13 weeks for extended benefits.
And that well could happen, given the past few months that have been trending downward. It could feasibly drop below 8% in the next month or two.
It could, but again, considering the it's a 3-month rolling average, it very well could. I mean, if the unemployment were dropped dramatically, then the 3-month rolling average could be could fall below 8%. I wouldn't expect that to happen immediately. And if it does happen, we have a 3-week period, so we'll trigger it off. We'll communicate that to individuals, and then so it's not like, you know, overnight we're going to turn off the benefits, and you're going to go from 20 weeks to 13. There'll be a little notice period. The other, I guess, important thing to note about these 7 additional weeks is that they're also applied to the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. So that program authorized benefits of up to 39 weeks. And just so your listeners understand, those 39 weeks could, if an individual collected 26 weeks of regular unemployment and then moved to the PUA program, they're entitled to 39 total weeks. With the 7 additional weeks, that number goes to 46. So for those individuals that are being provided benefits through that program, they too could benefit from the high unemployment period and the 7 additional weeks.
That certainly is an important detail. Can you offer an update on how things are going in the Division of Unemployment? I know this flood of claims for the past few months has caused you guys to hire on some new people and even expand the workplace where you're at. Can you offer an update on that front?
Sure. So we continue to hire additional resource. We are leasing. We've leased a new facility. We're within the next 10 days expected to take occupancy of that facility, which will give us room for some of the staff we have today, but also add probably an additional 30 people. So we are hiring additional claims processors. We're hiring individuals that we call them deputies, but they make the determination of eligibility on claims when there's a question about that. So we continue to add resources to try and help us manage through the backlog of claims that are still waiting for an answer of eligibility.
And what has that done to the division's budget? Is that then thereby straining the state's budget and maybe a need for federal support on that end?
Well, we've been very fortunate that we have received additional federal support. So through the first Coronavirus Response Act, the federal government appropriated $3 million in addition to to my division. So for this year, we received about $7.7 million in funding. Through the CARES Act, we got the $3 million, plus because of the additional volume of claims we've processed, they've appropriated an additional, $5 to $7 million. So we've been receiving additional assistance from the federal government to assist us with our response and the need to hire additional resources and put some new systems and tools in place to help manage this manage through this crisis. So at this point, the state has been willing to assist and provide us additional resource. But thankfully, the federal government, what people need to understand is unemployment, while managed locally, it's funded by the federal government. So the the leadership, the governor has asked, and the secretary have made sure that we had access to resources and things that we need. But the federal government has provided the funding so far to allow us to hire additional resources and implement those new systems.
All right, Daryl, is there anything else you'd like to add that we didn't go over?
The one update I'd like to provide is, I know there's been a lot of questions about the FEMA Lost Wage Assistance Program. And so when the federal pandemic unemployment compensation, the $600 program, expired, many individuals were left with just their weekly benefit amount as the benefit that they were receiving. And so through the president's memorandum, he authorized FEMA to issue grants of $300 for, and it's now been determined it's only going to be paid for 6 weeks. And so we have been actively working to implement and pay those benefits. It's only for 6 weeks for individuals that had previously certified that their unemployment was due to COVID. We have paid all 6 weeks as of yesterday to those individuals. For individuals that are receiving benefits through the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, and extended benefits, those are supported on our new system, and we've paid the first 5 weeks of benefits to those individuals, and the 6 week will be paid in the next day or so. And then the last group of individuals are individuals who filed their claim, but when they filed, they didn't certify that their unemployment was due to COVID. Some of those weren't given the opportunity to certify because we didn't have that functionality in place. And so we've been communicating via email, phone. We'll be sending letters to those that we can't reach through those other methods with directions on how to certify. And we'll be making payments to those individuals this week. So we by the end of the week, we will have paid the largest majority of individuals that will qualify for that benefit. But I know there's been a lot of questions about timing and with respect to us paying those benefits. And again, the majority have received at least 5 weeks of their payments. Some have received all six, and those that are having to certify again will make those payments by the end of the week.
Thanks to Delaware Division of Unemployment Director Daryl Scott and Arnick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. Enlighten Me is next, with more on two statues taken down in Wilmington during last summer's racial justice protests and where they fit into the nationwide discussion about monuments like these. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This summer, two statues were taken down in the city of Wilmington, one of Christopher Columbus, the other of Declaration of Independence signer and slave owner Caesar Rodney. The city has promised community conversations about the future of these monuments, and not everyone has been happy about their, at least temporary, removal. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with David Young, director of the Delaware Historical Society, about what the monuments really say about history and why they tend to stir up controversy.
Where do some of the monuments that have been removed in Wilmington, the Caesar Rodney statue and the Christopher Columbus statue, where do those stand right now?
It's my understanding that they are still within the holdings of the city, and the city has kept saying that there are plans for a public forum about what to do with the Caesar Rodney statue and the Christopher Columbus statue, but that is the extent of the details that have been made public.
So why is there such an intense debate around what to do with monuments in this country? Why does it tend to stir up passions? We saw Lauren Witzke and some supporters holding a protest over the summer over these two statues that were removed in Wilmington, urging them to be restored. Why do you think, you know, it becomes so controversial?
Well, statues are not history. Monuments are not history. They express community values at a certain point in time. And community values change with time. And the more we understand history, we see an evolving sense of history, and we rewrite it. That's our duty. That's why history is a form of literature. And we rewrite it, hopefully, together. But the monuments are part of the memory infrastructure. Museums, markers, and monuments create a kind of memory infrastructure. And often the memory infrastructure doesn't evolve as populations change, as socioeconomic conditions change, as the nation's understanding of the past change. So when the memory infrastructure, the monuments, the markers, and the museums are no longer representative of the population in which people see those monuments, a kind of cynicism develops, and the monuments represent out-of-touch impositions of community values that are no longer representative of the time.
Do we know what the circumstances around some of these statues in Delaware, like the two in Wilmington, when they were put up and why they were put up?
Yes. Most monuments are put up. The kinds of monuments that have sparked controversy and what Preservation Delaware is calling monument wars were put up as symbols of white power in periods in the 1890s, 19-teens, and 20s when there were intense debates about immigration and who had the right to vote and who could be a citizen. So they are meant to kind of be an in-your-face statement of power. That's why monuments are more than just a history book. They're actually an imposition of one perspective on the past. I will just say that most Christopher Columbus statues were put up as Italian Americans became more prominent voting blocks and wanted more representation in the body politic represented by the markers, monuments, and museums that make up the memory infrastructure. Similarly, you'll see Irish American statues to Revolutionary War heroes like Commodore Barry at Independence Hall in the 19-teens. And often those statues are granted when a public official wants to court that particular voting bloc. With Caesar Rodney, the effort to construct a statue went hand in hand with the effort to construct Rodney Square. And Rodney Square was crafted beginning in 1915 and ultimately christened in 1923. And the Delaware Historical Society was in charge of commissioning the artist James Kelly to be the sculptor of a statue for Caesar Rodney. So it went hand in hand with the idea of glorifying Rodney Square with ideals in the 1920s it was the DuPonts and John Jacob Raskob who designed Rodney Square. And like many of the statues installed in the 1920s, they were installing an idealized version of the colonial past with the idea that the past has more authority to the present because the present is seeing so much change. There are people coming north from the south because of the Great Migration. There are more and more immigrants coming into the country from all over the world and not simply places like Europe and white Caucasian immigrants to the United States. It's no surprise that the kinds of people like the DuPonts or the Rockefellers or Henry Ford who were installing monuments or creating museums like Colonial Williamsburg or Greenfield or Winterthur were idealizing the past and the colonial values when an idealized version of craft and beauty and colonial values were to be prioritized. And many of those same people, like the creators of Rodney Square, were at the same time Ford, Rockefeller, and the DuPonts promoting race-based ethnic quotas in American immigration law that culminated in the 1924 National Origins Act, which was only undone in the mid-1960s. So these two things go hand in hand, imposition of power, glorification of the past. And that's right about where the Caesar Rodney discussions to put him in a glorified equestrian statue mode between 1915 and 1924 fits the pattern of when similar monuments, museums, and markers were installed to represent a glorified past amid a changing demographic and changing population of the cities of the North.
Are there other monuments in Delaware that haven't gotten as much attention as the two in Wilmington that you think deserve a second look?
I think just about every building and historic marker deserve some look. Caesar Rodney's plantation Byfield, which is on the eastern end of the Dover Air Force Base. The Byfield Plantations marker installed in 2005 makes reference to none of the enslaved workers, and there were as many as 200 enslaved workers on that plantation property. The John Dickinson Plantation, which is known as a plantation, is undergoing a thoughtful consideration of what they should call the site, because much like the whipping post in public is a trigger, so is the name plantation. So there are many. There are far too many, too numerous for me to just cherry pick. But the markers that don't represent actual events of the past and simply gloss over, sugarcoat, or glorify, that'd be a good start, re-examining some of those markers. More recently, markers, let's say, at the Whitehall Plantation near Bombay Hook in Leipzig in 2017 specifically enumerates the numbers of enslaved on the Whitehall Plantation and names some of them. So there's a way to contextualize and to humanize through the memory infrastructure. The memory infrastructure can evolve, and it's where public historians have a responsibility to push the boundaries to make the monuments, the markers, and the museums more accurately representative of our evolving sense of history. So, for instance, if the Rodney statue were to come back, I would suggest perhaps we enumerate the kinds of people who had helped Rodney onto his horse, like Shadrach or Peg or Jude or Charles, or specifically lay out the names of the people as enumerated in Caesar Rodney's will, like Beth or Kate, who was to be freed 5 years after his death because she was still a breeding woman and worth 10 pounds. In other words, the kinds of things that people don't understand about Delaware history, these discussions offer us an opportunity to say, you know, Rodney specifically laid out the values of his individual and enslaved Africans, the workers on his property, because enslavers like Benjamin Chew and John Dickinson and Caesar Rodney and his brother Thomas amortized, loaned out, collected interest, and depreciated human beings as assets on their balance sheets and in their wills. And the value of 4 million enslaved in 1860 in the United States was $3,000,000,1860, greater than all the combined assets of the United States except the land. Well, if more people knew that, or knew that when Delaware calls itself the first state, it's only about the first 10 amendments, not about the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, which Delaware didn't ratify until 1901. So bringing more of that history to life and to light allows us to engage the public in discussions with more open eyes. I hadn't known that is often a response. Gee, how come this isn't taught in the textbooks? How come this isn't, how come I didn't know this about Delaware? That's our opportunity, because the more people know about the facts of the past, the more they may be able to see that these are not just exercises in political correctness. They are a responsible address of whether or not the monuments imposed on us 100 years ago adequately represent the population as it stands right now.
Thanks to our Sophia Schmidt and Delaware Historical Society Director David Young for their time on The Green this week. Next on The Green, Arts Playlist, and a look at this year's Big Draw Delaware Festival. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The 2020 Big Draw Festival Delaware is underway with events planned throughout the month. This year, the city of Milford is partnering with the Miss Pillion Art League to reinvent the community festival in light of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need for social distancing. And in this week's Arts Playlist, the festival's chair, Rosemary Connolly, joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss this year's largely virtual event with the theme, A Climate of Change.
How is COVID-19 going to affect this year's festival?
Well, you know, as you know, so many organizations have had to cancel their festivals because they couldn't hold large outdoor events. And so because last year we had such a great time with all of our Saturday free family events and lots of folks outside, but of course we can't do that this year. But because we're artists, we think outside the box. And we said, okay, what can we do to still offer a creative arts experience for our community during this time of COVID? And we decided that what we could do was put together what we're calling an idea booklet. And the idea booklet will have at least a dozen project ideas that folks, families, and kids can do at home and enjoy the process and be part of this festival by sharing photos of their creations on our Facebook page and social media. So we are partnering with the City of Milford, who has given us a grant, and they're also providing some materials for us, and we will be giving out a limited number of free art kits that will have our idea booklet plus sampling of materials, that some art supplies, some recycled stuff that can help them at least get started on their projects. The theme for this year is a climate of change, and it's all about recycling and ecology, protecting the planet and all that good stuff. So that's really what all of this is about. So it's all about recycling and ecology. So all of these projects, art projects that we're listing in our idea booklet will use recycled materials or have something to do with nature and the environment. And so that's the gist of what we're doing. And so, as I said, it's all about using recycled materials. And while we will be providing a limited amount of these, we encourage everyone to save and recycle their own things.
Couple of questions. First, yeah. Why this year's theme, a climate of change? Was there a reasoning behind that theme?
I have to tell you that we are part of the international celebration that actually began in the UK about the year 2000, and it's now in 25 or more countries around the world celebrating the drawing and the art making. And the international organization are the ones that come up with a theme each year. So we simply follow what they have come up with. So we really can't take credit for the creation of the theme.
Yeah, when I talked to you last year about the Big Draw Festival, you gave me some background about the Big Draw and the background. It really didn't originate here in the States, right?
No. It originated in the United Kingdom and in the year 2000. And so now over 25 countries celebrate this event. And while we take the theme from the international, we each create our own events. You know, there are no set things that we have to do or, you know, are not able to do. We can really come up with our own events and ideas for what we think our community would like to do.
Let's talk about funding for this year's event, because there was some controversy. Delaware Public Media, we here at Delaware Public Media, did a story back in late August that the City of Milford would be providing funding for this arts festival. Talk about that controversy. Why was it there?
There was a bit of controversy because the city has a regulation, I suppose, that they do not fund nonprofit organizations for their events. However, we met with the city and laid our case, and what was decided was that we would actually partner with the city, and they would provide some funding in the way of a grant that would help to pay the costs of our advertising and printing. But at the same time, they are going to be providing materials that they would like distributed to the city as well, that they've put together. So we will be, as I say, partners and handing out information that they would want to be distributing anyway. So we become a kind of an arm for them in helping to do that.
Yeah, and bringing our listeners, Rosemary, up to speed, we want to let them know that numerous council members donated a total of about $1,300 to help defray the cost from the city. So the city granted about $3,346 in total, right?
Actually, the city of Milford donated $2,000, and an additional $1,000 was donated by the Delaware Municipal Electric Corporation.
Gotcha.
And then the balance is donations that we received. So we actually raised about $5,000 in between those things, and that will help us pay for our advertising and promotional materials. Because of the way we're doing it this year, we felt it was really important to have some ads in newspapers and such. We got some great free press, if you will, articles that were written about us last year, but because we're not going to be outdoors and visible to folks just wandering by who may not have even seen any of that, we really got a lot of attention. But in the way that we're doing it now, we just felt it was really important to let people know that this was going on in spite of everything around us. So we're really excited because we're able to create these materials, the idea booklet, and all of our flyers and materials are bilingual, or we're having them translated into Spanish, so they'll be available in English and Spanish. So that was a plus also for the city. And, you know, you may know, but the theme, Milford's branding is Rivertown, Art Town, Hometown. So because we're an art town, they really were kind of very supportive of what we're doing. So we're really pleased.
Is it hard? Would you say it's hard to get funding in this era of COVID-19?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We were stretched. I mean, we were really... We had a plan B and a plan C. You know, if we couldn't get funding, how are we going to make this happen, you know, on a kind of shoestring budget? And we were going to make it work one way or another. But yes, it was difficult. It was difficult.
Yeah, nowadays you have to have a backup to the backup to the backup, if you will.
Exactly.
All right, let's tell people the dates of the festival. And again, clarify, is this part virtual, part in person? Because of COVID?
Thank you for asking that. Yes, we have about 18 classes running for the month of October, and they will be live at Miss Billion Art League with masks and social distancing. We have enough room and enough tables that everyone is at least 6 feet apart and wearing masks. And so, and because it's this festival that we want accessible to everyone, some of our classes are as little as $10. You know, it goes from sort of $10 and $15 on up to maybe a 6 week watercolor class that might cost more. But we're really trying to make these things accessible and encourage our entire community to take part. So we say the festival is for artists and non-artists, families and kids. So it's, you know, in trying to just make art accessible, that, you know, it's just a fun thing to take part in. I do want to tell you about one of our big things that we're doing. We are planning to create a cardboard city, and we're asking everyone to create a house or a store or some kind of a building out of their imagination or something in their town, and then bring their finished creation to the Art League, where we will be setting up our cardboard city. So it will be up through the beginning of December, through the holiday time, and just we're really excited about what folks are going to do. I actually did one myself, and it was so much fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun. So the 18 classes throughout the month of October are live at the Mills Pillion Art League. Where can people get the dates and the times of those classes?
They can go to our website, which is Miss Pillion, and I'll spell it MISPILLION arts with an S.org. And on our Facebook page as well. There's also a Facebook page for the Big Draw Delaware that they can find.
Will there be a festival part of this in downtown Milford like in past years?
No, there will not be anything live. The festival is is participating in the projects that we do, and the way you participate is by posting on social media and sharing it. And so it is not a live festival per se, but it is a festival nevertheless. So we're still celebrating art and mark making in the month of October.
Thanks to Big Draw Festival Chair Rosemary Connolly and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. More information on this year's Big Draw Festival is available at the event's Facebook page, The Big Draw DE. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalina, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.